Welcome to the Six Again podcast, your new destination for all things NRL. Here to bring you everything from team news to best bets are your hosts Adam Hoy and Jared Mutton. Let's kick off.
All right, welcome back, guys. So this is going to be a pretty big episode. We've got an interview coming up with the one and only Jamie Soward. It's pretty heavy hitting. He puts forward a lot of opinions, and it was bloody fun to do. How you been, Jared?
Yeah, good. Unfortunately, I wasn't actually able to make that meeting. People still have to work, so I was stuck in work while Adam was having a great conversation.
I worked before and after that really hard, but it was an awesome way to spend the middle of the day, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, no, I've already actually listened to the podcast, guys. It's one of the better ones. It's really, really good.
Yeah, out of the two interviews that we've done, it's definitely in the top two.
Yeah, no, definitely up there.
But basically, because it goes for a little bit of time, we're only going to do a quick intro today. We're just going to touch on the main talking points with regards to the proposed starting date of the NRL and then all of the TV deal news that's been coming through. And after the interview, we'll just do a quick update on what's coming up through the week and into next week's show. So, who wants to kick this one off?
Oh, we can start on how Channel 9 have been kicked in the ass the way they've been acting. Really? So what's come out that they were really considering not even letting NRL play this year.
Yep.
But now since, what is it, $250 million from a London firm or a bunch of London banks coming together, and the NRL has secured a bit of a funding there. What's it, $100 million
up front with $150 million in reserves.
Yeah, so. And then on top of that, there's been rumours going around, and they are unconfirmed, but it is out there that Channel 7 are looking at buying the rights if Channel 9 shit the pot, which would be a massive coup.
Where do you come up with these sayings?
You love them. Massive coup for Channel 7, because what does that mean if maybe they won't get the money out of it this year, but in the long-term future, if they treat the NRL right, well, what will they have? They'll have the AFL, cricket, Wimbledon, Australian Open. They'll have that as well.
Olympics when it comes back on.
Olympics. So they're going to have the rights, the exclusive rights to 99% of the sport in Australia.
And Channel 10's got the golf, I'm pretty sure. So
yeah,
so Channel 9 announced this week that golf's going to be probably the first sport getting back up and running.
Yeah, so Channel 9 had the crowning jewel, as far as we're concerned, rugby league. Maybe not in Victoria. But if Channel 9 keep this hard stance, and maybe they'll lose, what, $130 million this year if they play NRL, which is what they're worried about.
Mm-hmm.
But if they aren't prepared to lose that and think 10 years down the future, this is going to be a big deal, like a massive shift in an Australian sporting landscape where, when you think about it, if Channel 7 gets all the live sport, including State of Origin in finals, bye-bye Channel 9, really.
Ching, ching.
What are they going to have? Like, what do they have now other than sport? I don't even know.
I don't know. I don't watch any free-to-air.
Yeah, but other than rugby league, of course.
All right. But, yeah. So, just to try and tie all this together, we've put forward basically a time frame or timeline of what's going on. So, NRL came out and proposed their start date of the 28th of May. And then we talked about how they had hurdles and stuff they had to overcome, one of it being the actual schedule and TV rights. Channel 9 not so keen on that, because basically, like Jared said, if they continue the season from now on, looking at the 15 rounds that was first proposed, Channel 9 stood to lose $130 million. So they basically wanted to stall as long as possible so there's less content to put on, so there's a higher chance of no NRL this year, which wouldn't want obviously work then for Fox Sports or the NRL. In the first meeting, they've come out and said they want exclusive rights to the Friday and the Sunday games. So no Fox Sports being involved at all. And they also wanted the removal of the 6 p.m. game on the Friday night. So they'd have the exclusive Friday night only game because they know how much the viewership shifts because there's two games rather than one. Fox Sports want the schedule to remain the same. They want the same access to all matches, even though Channel 9 said, if we have the Friday night, you can have the Thursday night. Anyway, so this is pretty much the aggressive approach that Channel 9 said. It's either you give us these or we're going to pull our support for this year and we're not going to have a showcase. And then, and NRL was not in a great spot then. Then this Oakwell Advisory Group from the UK came forward with $250 million, $100 million up front, $150 in reserves. Now, each season, the NRL gets $300 million from Fox Sports and Channel 9 combined. So for an advisory group to come forward and put up $250 million, it pretty much covers both companies put together. So it puts the NRL in a good position, puts NRL, Channel 9 in the, on the back foot. Once that came out, then we started hearing these whispers of Channel 7 going, well, if the NRL's got this money in the bank, Channel 9's kind of doesn't have the same leg to stand on. If we can sniff around here and say, look, we can put this up with the Olympics being postponed till next year, Wimbledon being cancelled, AFL still up in the air, Channel 7's got some money to play with. That's been pretty cool. And then this American consortium, Jared found out, he was doing some research last night, this, it's called Park Lane. Basically what they do, and it looks pretty pretty cool, is...
Oh, it's going to change the landscape of rugby league if it comes, in.
Yes, it most definitely will. So this Park Lane group, I'm just going back to our research here. I'm trying to get the wording right. So there you go. They're a firm specializing in assisting high net worth individuals become owners of sporting franchises. So basically these guys help rich people own NFL, NBA, NHL, MLB clubs. And they've come to the NRL saying, look, we've got a hell of a lot of money. How about we come in there and purchase part of the NRL to help you get your cash flow back on track, which sounds very much like private ownership of clubs. You keep reading along, they're more interested in buying the entire league. Landies have come out and said that they're not going to give up this majority share, but a minority stake could be in the offering. So that's a lot of stuff that goes went on in the last week. Where does that leave us right now? Tuesday, we've got the commission meeting, so ARLC, Australian Rugby League Commission meeting. So that's Vlandys, Peter Beattie, Megan Davis, Wayne Pearce, who's the head of the Apollo Project.
And
Apollo.
Greg Weiss.
Tony McGrath. They'll be discussing the American Consortium proposal and the London investment to look at how much money they will have going forward. That's going to happen on Tuesday. Then on Wednesday is the Project Apollo meeting. So Jared said that Wayne Pearce will have a whole bunch of paperwork to take to the thing saying, look, we're still starting on blah and blah. This is how many weeks it's going to be. This is what the schedule is going to look like. And this is how much money we've got.
I imagine by Thursday, we're going to have a lot of information. But I was just thinking about the whole Channel 7, Channel 9, Fox Sports thing. Channel 9 have been kind of, when you think about it, very lax in the last probably 5-6 years now they're treating NRL. So their approach to it has been less is more. So obviously they've had less games in Fox Sports, but they've had the State of Origin and exclusive finals. Rights to finals.
Oh, so, grand final.
Yeah, so they've been very, because of that, they've always had the crown jewel of rugby league. They'd be very relaxed. Like Fox Sports have been coming up behind them with better shows, better broadcasting, more wide range of commentators and expert opinions.
Despite the fact
people don't like certain personalities on there, they've got a lot of ex-players and stuff. Like Channel 9, their crown jewel's probably been the footy
Fittler
show.
And Johns?
Yeah, it's gone. Footy show's gone.
Yeah.
They fired Matty Johns, which was a big deal because he's probably the leading man in Fox Sports Rugby League right now.
Yeah.
So I think they've been a bit silly the last maybe 10 years of how they treated rugby league. And this has kind of brought it all to light. And the fact that rugby league don't have any money anymore, or they didn't 2 weeks ago, And now they do. It's kind of put them in a really bad spot of how they've acted this whole situation. So it's going to be really interesting what happens to Channel 9 now if they don't, well, not pull their head in, but start really thinking about what they're doing, because their coverage hasn't been as good recently, and the footy show's gone now. So, like,
and you've got Matty John's show on Fox, you've got the games with no ads, that sort of stuff. But also,
yeah, NRL 360.
Foxtel's also the other one that's struggling as well. Like, their numbers are dropping a lot because of all the streaming service and stuff doing so well, especially at the moment. So, if they can come out of this with something extra or one less competitor, that's going to be huge. So, this meeting on Tuesday literally has the potential to change the entire rugby league landscape, not just with broadcasting, but could be even overseas consortiums or companies having some form of controlling rights over our game.
Yeah.
Now, if Philandis, sorry, I just dropped my pen. If Philandis is correct in saying they'll have a minority stake, it's more just cash flow, but it could open the opportunity to private ownership of clubs down the track.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing. Like, rugby league, there's always a team that come out probably once every 3 years and say they're bankrupt. And so you got someone who has a minority stake in the NRL and might go, oh, I've got a $10 million sitting there. I can bail them out. NRL are going to jump on that chance. So it's a foot in the door, which could become completely wide open eventually. So,
could you look at Forbes 2 weeks ago? I think a week and a half ago, they always announced like the value ship of sports teams. And you had the Yankees came in at $5 billion. So you're looking at one sporting team in the States, so obviously the biggest baseball team in the world, but worth $5 billion of one team. So the people that are involved in this Park Lane stuff, they're used to companies worth billions of dollars, but teams, one team. Now, when you got one team worth more than our entire game, it's going to be damn interesting to see what's going to happen. I like the look of this $250 million from the London Consortium. So basically, it gives the NRL a bit more of a bargaining chip to Channel 9, saying, if you pull out, we've got this money in cash reserve. If you want to take us to court, we can use it there as well if we need to.
Yeah, and it's not like I keep saying, it's not like NRL don't have our options right now. So it's just,
it's going to be damn interesting to see what happens on Tuesday.
Tuesday and Wednesday, especially Thursday when everything gets consolidated and put together, it's going to be really
huge.
Get on the news and see what happens.
All right, guys, we're going to wrap up there on that topic. After the Soward interview that we're about to go into, we'll give you an update on what the show is going to look like moving forward. So here's the interview with Jamie. Really hope
see you guys. Bye.
All right, guys. So this is our interview with Jamie Soward. Unfortunately, Jared can't be with us today. He's working. But we've got Jamie on the line.
Hey, mate.
How you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm looking forward to this. I've been doing a fair few interviews and podcasts and stuff. I think everyone's got the podcast bug, but looking forward to it. I like the fact that everyone can come up with different questions. So hopefully we get a little bit weird this afternoon.
Yeah, I think we will. So we said before the show, I've got a couple of cousins in Sydney who have thrown through some questions. We've got a mate who's a diehard Dragons fan, and you're definitely one of his favourite players. So he's sent through a couple, and then we've got kind of our bank of questions as well. So I just want to throw it straight off the bat. You're definitely seen as one of the unique characters when you were playing and post-career as well. So a bit different, that sort of stuff. One thing that jumped out to me was I had a bit of reading. I think you were jumping between the Roosters to Dragons and you did it on a handshake agreement. And you said always handshakes before contracts.
Yeah, it was. I worked like that my whole career, pretty much. So when I left Canberra, I moved up to the Roosters, and before I'd sort of signed the contract, I'd just moved up, handshake deal, and then got the contract afterwards. And then when I left to go to the Dragons, it was I actually played first grade that week before for the Roosters, and went to Wagga for one of my best mates' fathers had passed away, so. The word had come through that I was going to sign with the Dragons, and The Roosters rang and said, you know, we want you to stay. And I'd already said that I'd handshake deal with Nathan Brown, that if they could make it work, I was going to come across to the Dragons. So, yeah, I was pretty adamant like that. Same thing happened when I went to Penrith. You know, the Sharks rang me the night before and I was about to sign, and I'd already handshake deal with Phil Gould. And yeah, it was, I don't know, I was just brought up that way that, you know, your handshake and your word is what you judge by. And regardless of everything else that I've gone through in my life, I could always say that I honoured those handshake deals, and it worked out for me.
That's awesome. So it's definitely something I think a lot of us grow up doing, but in the professional sporting world, it's not something that really you hear about, considering all the transfer process media and stuff. It's like, it came down to a handshake. That's really cool.
Yeah, it was, I mean, for me, even when I re-signed at the Dragons, it was, Wayne rang me in 09 and said, this is the deal, take it or leave it. And I just said, sweet, whatever.
Yeah, cool.
Get it done. And then when I re-signed at the end of that deal again, before I left the Dragons, it was just, I didn't really, contracts for me were always going to take care of themselves. And no matter what people outside, in terms of having worked both sides media, it's our job to speculate what the person's on and all that kind of stuff, because that's what drives the engine for the NRL to keep getting multi-billion dollar deals. But for me, I never saw it like that. I just saw it as, if I was playing good, I was going to get a contract, and when it came to crunch, I'd like to get it done as quick as possible versus drag it out. And I was never big enough to drag it out anyway. I wasn't a real big name in terms of a star recruit or anything like that. I just like to get it done and get to work.
Well, a couple of things you said in there that I had for later in the interview, but when you said seeing it from both points of view, media and a player, you've made a couple of comments that you felt as a player, the media might criticise you and didn't get as much respect maybe for some of the things you did in the playing career, but now you see it from the media point of view and you see why they do it or how they do it. Has that kind of...
It's a tough one, because early on, I've always wanted to work in the media, and early on, I probably had worked out the media game before my time and before I'd actually done anything in the game. So I kind of demanded that respect early on, that I probably hadn't done enough in the game to have that clout behind me. So that clout, be able to have that sort of stuff behind me. So when I went to the media, I try and just call it straight down the line, and some players don't like it. Aiden Caesar last year called me out on a live show that he thought I'd been harsh on him all year, and it wasn't personal. It's never personal with me. It's never, if people don't like me, I don't care. But how I call the game and how I judge players is that performance inside that, the four white lines for 80 minutes. And that I felt like at times throughout my career that I was being judged by my personality versus what I was actually doing on the field. And if you look back to those 3 years, 09, 10, 11, 09 especially, I don't think I got enough respect for how good the team was playing, what I was doing inside the team, and personally how my season was going, coming from nowhere. In 08, didn't play a finals game, to 09, up there for the Dally M pretty much all year. So I felt disrespected, but I also played that up a bit because I wanted the chip on my shoulder. So moving to the media now, I see the transition is hard, but a lot of those people that probably gave me a hard time now didn't understand my character. I'm an emotional person. I like taking the piss out of myself. So a lot of those times I felt like I was ahead of the game, and those people didn't understand me, but now they work with me and they understand that I'm the exact same as I was back then. I just know how to work it a little bit better.
That's like refreshingly honest, like a player, ex-player, like calling themselves out, saying, this is what I thought then. In hindsight, I might have been ahead of myself, but in other ways, I'm going to stick true to my word and that they're my beliefs, and that's what I'm going to follow through on. That's awesome.
Yeah, well, it's in Australia, there's heroes and villains. Every great superhero has a villain that they go up against, and not everyone can be the great guy that you want to have a beer with. Unfortunately, for all the listeners, the kids and stuff like that, if you have one lesson, not everyone has to be that person that you're a great guy. We spoke off air about James Maloney, polarizing figure, but is a winner. And at the end of the day, you're judged on whether you win or lose. So for me, I didn't mind playing the villain. I still don't mind playing the villain. I think that my social media and my opinions are my own, and people don't agree with them. And that's great. That's what makes, as long as you do it respectfully, I think that can make really good content and conversation, stuff like that. But I don't mind having a beer by myself. I don't have to be the center of attention. And I think a lot of people get caught up in that. They change the way that they perceive themselves and present themselves to try and be that nice guy, because every Aussie wants, I want to have a beer with that guy. You can't just talk yourself up. And you know, the other example of that is recently I picked on my podcast, I picked my greatest ever St. George Illawarra side.
I saw that.
And the question I asked was, should you be able to put yourself in the side? Now, not necessarily my own opinion, but yeah, because I felt like Anthony Mundine was the best 5'8 that St. George Illawarra had had in that short time. Trent Barrett very close, and then I would consider myself probably third. But when a guy like Cameron Smith has to pick the greatest ever Melbourne side, are you telling me he's not going to put himself in the side? But if he did that, he'd be classed as a wanker, right? So
is that what Hindmarsh said? I'm not going to put myself in my team. I'd be a dickhead. Right. Yeah,
that's exactly right. So that's the whole, everyone, you know, there's an aspect of everyone that we all want to be liked, but you know, sometimes if you just call it how you see it, the small minority might respect it. But I think that's been actually, you know, true to what yourself and how your character is.
Yeah. So just be yourself. And if people like you for who you are, then they'll be more loyal and long time friends than those who are pretending to be.
I don't need any more friends. I got my wife and daughter.
And your daughter.
And, another one on the way. So mate,
congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. I couldn't give a toss about having more friends. I care about them and the work and yeah, my tight circle has always been my tight circle. It hasn't changed for 20 odd years. So I don't really. I think if you're comfortable within yourself and you have your tight group, the rest of it you just let it go.
Beauty. I've got a couple of things we'll come back to with regards to that. But talking about your individual aspects, basically the goal kicking always comes up, and that was from a session with Graham Arnold. Is that correct? You were working on goal kicking with him before he was the Australian football coach. And, you said you kicked him at about 70% from then on. So not the best, but definitely not the worst, but the actual routine, was that part of that session with Graham Arnold?
No, I don't know how the routine started. It was just one of those things. I think it was about getting my body moving into the ball and putting my foot closer to the footy and going through it. Unfortunately, my percentages took a huge hit when Brett Morris scored, I think, 50-odd tries in
out on the wing.
out on the wing. So that was always tough. But, yeah, goal kicking is one of those things that I teach kids now, and you've got to want to do it. And I didn't want to do it early on from an early age, and sort of got talked into it because no one else wanted to, and then worked hard at it. And you know, you're doing maybe 3,000 kicks, potentially for 150 kicks throughout the year. You know, it's a lot of work and a lot of discipline. So the run up just happened to come about. The session with Graham Arnold changed my goal kicking career, trajectory in terms of 70% was, not many guys kick above 80. And especially if, a lot of those times you're in the playmaking role and all that kind of stuff, you've got everything going on. So I was happy with how I kicked the ball. I could have probably kicked a little bit better here and there. But that session after Graham Arnold at Cogra, just me, him and Kurt Wrigley, really changed the trajectory of what I thought about goal kicking angles. I found myself concentrating and practicing a lot better after that session about angles and through the ball and all that kind of stuff that I'd worked with Craig Fitzgibbon and Daryl Halligan on, and but I never really probably quite connected as I did with that one session. And then after that, when I worked with Chook again out of Penrith, a lot of those things were already in place that had been in place for years, so I sort of understood them a lot better. But Graham Arnold was fantastic.
And you're comparing then with Fitzgibbon and Halligan. They had a lot more curve on the ball. Yours was just that straight through it, the straight trajectory, end over end, that sort of stuff. Yeah. So when you're saying the angles, is that talking about when you're actually lining it up on the tee as opposed to the angle of your leg coming through the ball, or a bit of both?
No, it's more angles of shoulders and, you put the ball on the tee. The run up for me was always the same. So fall back, three to the side, turn around, march, whatever else happened. But the angles of where your shoulders are, because you're trying to get through the ball as best as you can without changing motion from where you are in the field. So, for instance, if I was on the right-hand side of the field, left foot kicker, my shoulders had to be square with the ball to be able to go straight through like that. If I was just a little bit off, you could see I never wanted to hook the ball to the left, to the right-hand post. I wanted to always push that left upright. So for me, I'd always concentrate on the left screw between the crossbar and where the post is. Every footy post has it, the screw to join. And if I focus there, all I was thinking was left upright, because for me, I didn't curl the ball back in, but I knew that I could get through that so that if I did miss right, I was thinking that left way. You never wanted to see a left foot kicker hook to the right-hand side of the post.
That's really cool. So it's much more like planes of motion and biomechanics rather than a specific routine. And you're saying inside the left post, that's actually, we're doing a bit of research around Jared Croker, what everyone's asking what he says before he kicks it. Yeah. He says, that's what he's saying, inside the left post, inside the left post. Yep. That's what he says. Yeah, cool. And also just the running out on the field at the start. I know that was something that fans were kind of love you for it or hated it, the whole run out, jump up and down, pump yourself up. I never saw it either way. You were never on one of the teams that I supported, but my mate, he loved it. He loved the fact that you were running out there, just pumping the crowd up, pumping yourself up. Again, something that just you did from a kid, like you did that all growing up, or was it once you got to the NRL, you had that atmosphere and the adrenaline and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I don't know. Puffing out the cheeks, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, it was probably a little bit of showmanship, I would say.
Because I love, like, guys, I can see Jamie on the video and he had, like, a bit of a cheeky smile on before he started answering this one. He's like, yeah, that's what I did.
Yeah, it was a bit, probably a bit of showmanship. I don't know when it started, actually, but I carried it through probably when Wayne came through. It was a way to get my nervous energy out before a ball was kicked. I was quite footy orientated for, a lot of my life, especially, through the first grade, just concentrated on footy. I didn't have many hobbies or anything like that. So a lot of everything went into winning or losing on a Sunday or whenever we played. So getting my nervous energy was out of the way, but I just loved, by the end of it, there were some nights where I probably gave a little bit extra just because I knew that we're playing in a hostile environment. And weirdly enough, I enjoyed people booing me because I knew that either way that night, they were going to talk about me, whether they'd run over me and their team had made me look stupid, even though I'd tried my ass off, or I'd broken their hearts. And I'd lucky enough to say that, apart from Melbourne and probably one or two other teams, I'd had a couple of heartbreaking moments against the rest of the competition. So that was pretty cool.
Would Greg Inglis be one of those?
Oh, mate.
You don't need to go into that one.
Oh, I don't really care. Like I still see people today and they're like, people on Twitter say, oh, remember when GI ran over you? Of course I do. It was the first game of the year, 09, 5 minutes into the season, GI drifted
across. GI in his prime.
I've seen it. But, I never really dwelled on that moment. He got me once again at Cogra, but I was like, what would you expect me to do? I tried, It was one of those moments in my life where I look back and I think, I could have gone low. I could have done a million other things. But, we all make mistakes. We all, make bad decisions. For me, it was how we bounce back. And what people don't realise is, we score a try with a minute to go in that game in 09. And I've got a kick from near the sideline to tie it, to send it into Golden Point. Now, if I had carried that first involvement of 2009 being pushed off by GI for the rest of the season, I wouldn't have had the season I had and I wouldn't have been able to come up with that kick. So
That's an awesome piece of advice.
Yeah. I don't really care what people say about that because the people that comment on it are the people that have watched it and probably never played. And it's an easy out for an NRL player or an athlete to say you've never played. But I think what people don't like is the fact that I call them out on it. And that's where they start getting a little bit pissy. They want the reaction. They get the reaction they don't like, and then they start getting upset about it. So, I think if you look back at that game, coming up with that clutch kick, and Wayne never, ever made me feel bad for my defense on GI. I never, ever felt bad. I was always cautious of trying to get my body in front, and that was my job. But my job wasn't to make 50 tackles. My job was for other things in the team.
Yeah, and Inglis's job was to run at the half, regardless of what team he was playing.
Exactly, and right.
That's it. I coach some high school footy, and mainly girls, actually, and then more so now, grown up playing footy, but a lot of them don't grow up playing footy, and just teaching them how to tackle. And if they do come up against a bigger opposition, we call it the ugly tackle. Literally just get the body in front, get your head out of the way, and do as best you can, because it means you've put your body there to start with. If you'd stepped aside and just let him run through, that was going to say a hell of a lot more, because you actually put yourself there. How many people in the public would actually still put themselves in front of GI to put themselves in that position to start with? So well, that's a big thing with regards to your, like, just character. The fact that you tried is something that the knowledgeable NRL and rugby league community would respect.
Yeah, and, you know, when you look at the statistics of, you know, Phil Gould sat us down at Penrith one day and just, I hadn't played a game yet, and he talked about all the players that had played NRL. There was 10,300 and something that have ever played NRL. And he spoke about that, you know, 30% of those guys have played one game or less than 10 games or something like that. So courage for me isn't me smashing Greg Inglis, or, you know, courage for me is working my ass off for 20 years to get to that point, to put myself in a position to play NRL, firstly, and then to be able to do it week after week for 12 years and play 200 games. That's courageous. Yeah, I'm not the biggest guy. I'm not going to smash anyone, but, you know, being able to put your body in front and prepare and be disciplined enough for that long, that's courageous. That's what discipline is about, being courageous. It's not necessarily about being the toughest and smartest. And that's what I say to young kids, the wait for age debate and teaching kids how to tackle and all that kind of stuff is, well, yep, the smaller kids end up making all the money because they're the smartest.
Yeah,
they play all the important positions, right? But if you get your body in front and try, no one will ever knock you for trying.
Yeah,
it's the what you just said then, Adam, about getting out of the way. And sure, there's times where I would like to have changed my tackle technique, but there's other times where, you know, I got smashed and knocked out. Yeah, is that courageous because I got knocked out? No, it's stupid. Yeah, it's stupid the fact that we look at it that way. So, yeah, I've always just thought that getting to first grade is courageous enough, and being able to perform on the big stage, that was courageous.
That's huge. I love that answer. That's so good. Just jumping into, you mentioned Wagga Wagga was your junior club. You're in the Raiders system. You moved to Sydney with the Roosters Jersey Flag team, who were brilliant. Won the 2004 Premiership with them. On the back of two of your field goals, and then jumping into the Roosters side, because that was after Brad Fittler had retired, and then kind of in and out of the team, and then you did the handshake deal over to the Dragons, and that's where we probably saw your best overall and best consistency of footy, especially 9 and 10. You get your Dally M medal in Dally M 5-8 of the year, 2009, and the Proven Summons medal. The questions that we basically had around them was, the turnover of 2008 to 2009 at the Dragons. So you had players kind of like Wendell Saylor had signed Jeremy Smith coming in, Darius Boyd, Costigan, Luke Prittis, Michael Wayman, and Bennett there as well. Question I had from a couple of guys was, what made the biggest difference, or was it a combination of things? Was it Bennett's influence, the influx of new players, to go from what was happening in 2008 to what happened in 2009, being minor premiers?
Yeah, I think 2008, I mean, I'd only been there for a year and a half, but 2008, it sort of, by the time New Wayne was coming, I wouldn't say it got stale, but, you know, Brownie had been there and sort of had his chance to get those.
Because he'd been there since, what, 08? Something like that?
Brownie had been there since.
Yeah,
2003. So he sort of had the best squads, you know. And the squad we had in 08, probably 09, 10, wasn't anywhere near that squad, those squads in 05. And, you know, when Wayne came to the club, it was the influx of new players, excitement. You know, we've got the greatest coach of all time. We've got, you know, this renewed belief within each other that we may not be the most talented, but we're going to be the fittest, you know, and everyone has that goal. But we did a preseason camp, came away with a lot of confidence, and I don't think we expected ourselves to be as good as what we were in 09. I look back to that first game against Melbourne, we'd come off and we were bitterly disappointed that we'd lost the game, and all that kind of stuff. And Wayne walked in the sheds and said, I feel sorry for you. And everyone sort of looked up and he said, I feel sorry for you that that's the standard you've set yourselves at game one. I thought it was going to take a long time. Yeah, not a long time, but I thought we're going to work up to that performance in 6-7 weeks where we get that performance and we think, right, we're a gritty team. We're going to, all that kind of stuff. But we'd gotten to it in game one. So we'd sort of surprised him and surprised ourselves. We beat the Sharks 10-6 a week later in an ugly win at Cogra. But after that, we started to roll. So I think it was a combination of everything. Wayne certainly had a majority to do with that. But, unlocking a person like myself, a conversation. It's after training one day, I probably hadn't trained my best. And he called me over and he just said, I want you to tell me 5 things you're good at. And I said, being the guy, the humble guy that everyone wants to be, as I was talking about before, I'm not really sure. And he said, well, if you don't know what you're good at, then what are you doing here? So I gave him the 5 things that I was good at, which was, I was fast and kick the ball and all that kind of stuff. And he said, right, we'll just work on that. Your defense, we'll work out ways to get your defense right. So, and you just work on what you're good at and what you can do for the team. You've got 17 guys every week believing that all they have to do is concentrate on themselves and do their part for the team. And I've used it many times. It becomes like a conveyor belt. Your job is to put the left wheel on the car. Don't worry about the right back wheel. That's my job's to do the left wheel. Someone else's job's to do the steering wheel. And everyone did that for 3 years pretty much. And we ended up, 2 minor premierships, a competition, a world club champion, and 3 finals appearances. So it was certainly a turnaround of, I guess, belief and Wayne and players, but it all just worked together.
The main thing I took out of that was the simplification.
Yeah.
Just considering how much we go into statistics and patterns and game plans, etc. If you can simplify it down to one person, one role, that's way less to deal with.
If we'd come off a bad game, we came off a bad game and made 12 errors. If everyone thinks, well, I didn't make an error, and someone else made 1 error. If everyone thinks they can make 1 error, that's 17 errors a week. If everyone thinks they can miss 1 tackle, that's 17 missed tackles before we get out on the field. So, our thing was people are going to make mistakes. People are going to miss tackles. That's just the way it is. It's how we scrambled and responded to that and stayed in games. And plan A, was our thing. If we stuck to plan A, we were going to win. But as soon as we started to change our game plan and got frustrated with each other, we didn't even come close to playing like the game that we wanted to play. And we did that the first half of the grand final. And Wayne said, that's not the Dragons out there. The Dragons that I know are ruthless, defensive, stuff like that. And we came out and smashed them second half. Yeah. But it was the simplification of what Wayne had brought to the club to be able to let players excel in their own environment without overcomplicating and making other people worry about other people's jobs.
Cool. At the end of that 2009 season, so you minor premiers, dominant the majority of the season, and then knocked out of the finals 2 straight games.
Mm.
What was the aftermath of it, firstly? So, literally post-match, but then over the break and then coming back to pre-season next year for your premiership year, was there emotional, mental scarring? What was the player's response, Wayne's response? Was it a shock?
Yeah, no, Wayne, I spoke to Dean Young. We did a documentary for NRL.com that'll be out. We thought it was going to be out this year, but probably later. The message from Wayne, and it reminded me, because you forget a lot of things, obviously, but it was, we're not going to change anything. After we lost that game to Brisbane, we're not going to change anything. We just need to do what we've been doing better and at the right time of the year. So, disappointed. I dreamt of holding up that trophy my whole life and to finish first and think we're going to run the comp here. And then we go bang, bang. We lose 8th at Cogra, which was embarrassing, 1-8. After beating him by 40 points the week before. Yeah. And then you go to Brisbane and I think the devastation of losing at Cogra probably carried over into Brisbane and we're up against it up there. So, but 2010, we came back and, we trained the house down. We we didn't change a thing. We just came back and did it all better. And it was about, we knew that we were good enough to get back to where we wanted to go. It was just being able to perform. I think the most nervous that I was wasn't the whole 2010 season. It was that first game against Manly in the quarterfinals at Cogra. Because, yeah, again, you know, 1v8. They'd had a lot of injuries. They weren't expected to win, as he touches the managers. But they weren't expected to win. They were, you know, up against it. And it was a tight game in the first half. And then we ran away with it. But, we didn't change anything. We still went left with Darius and Brett Morris. We still kicked and chased. And we still defended our asses off. So, the scarring, I think, was external versus internal. You know, motivation was always to get back to that spot. But the external pressure and media and all that shit was from outside. Yeah.
As a Manly supporter, I hated playing you guys through those years because we'd won the premiership in 08 and 11. But I still don't remember beating you guys any time over at Wynn or Jewel or any of them. It was like you were kind of like our bogey side, like Canberra ended up being for the Dragons for a few years. I was just like, we just can't bloody beat the Dragons over there. I was just like, come on. Bloody hell.
Yeah, it's always...
I was probably sitting there going, run it, Soward, run it,
Soward. Oh, mate, you're joining everyone else.
So you go through then 2000 and... through 2010, and one of the other ones, I guess one of the only real criticisms of the Dragons over 09 and 010 was you were and Melbourne Storm gets this as well through all their success, was you're a team, you're front runners. The only time you seem to struggle is if you fell behind in games. And then 2010, you were behind in the prelim final and then again behind in the grand final. And I think you've already touched on it, what Bennett said, you weren't the Dragons in the first half. Was that the main message? You're not playing like yourselves?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know anyone that, this is the perception in the media. I don't know anyone that doesn't like playing from in front.
No, yeah.
Penrith,
I think what they might have saying is you're free-flowing talent. Cowboys did it 3 or 4 years ago where they were the second half and they just put on like... 30 points.
Yeah, Penrith done it as well the last couple of years. The comeback kids, but you can't win competitions like that. Because what happens is you tread a fine line of, we did it 1 week, we did it 2 weeks. Oh, wow, we're still doing it. Yeah, but everything needed to go right in those situations. You come up against a team that doesn't give you that and it's over. And that's why Penrith haven't been able to progress past the second week, three out of the last 4 years or something like that. So, of course, everyone likes being front runners. We were criticised for how boring we were taking the two, up 6-0, you've had the ball for 5 minutes, you take 2 points. Like, we cared about winning. We didn't care what the score was. We didn't care, what you thought of it. We weren't out there to aesthetically please you from a viewer's point of view. Dragons fans cared about winning. The players cared about winning. The coaches cared about winning. And that's why we're successful. I don't think that any fan would care. Yeah, sure, you want to see plenty of points. But if you're sacrificing those wins, fans wouldn't want you to do that. So, the main message I always tell, Wayne come in, we're 8-6 down. The prelim final for me was the grand final. That's no disrespect to the Roosters or the Titans, but I felt like that was the main matchup that was going to decide that premiership that year. And in the first half, Tigers, it was huge. 80,000 2 weeks in a row for a kid that grew up in Wagga was unbelievable. But that prelim final was ebbs and flows, momentum tight, not going to be a lot of points, it's going to come down to one or two plays. And then, that's what happens. Grand final was probably going to be a little bit more open once both teams settled down. The Roosters settled a lot quicker than us. We scored first, but we probably didn't settle into our game. And then at halftime, Wayne's chatting and stuff. And I remember him saying, all we have to do is win the second half. And I near smirked. I've told that story many times because if we didn't win the second half, we weren't going to win.
Yeah, so, we're down 8-6.
8-6 down. So, it's, again, the simplicity of Wayne's message. He went into other stuff there, but the simplicity to be able to settle his team down and say, you're not playing like Dragons. You boys, if we don't win the second half, we're not going to win. And that, for a kid that had all the pressure on him in the last 2 years and, this was his biggest day, It settled me right down, and I always mention that first set after half time. We kick in behind BJ Leilua, who we kicked to exclusively that day. We got a good set. It rolled down to about a metre out from the line, and you just look up and there was 12. I think maybe even Darius was in there as well. We all chased that first kick like it was the start of the game, and from that point on, we didn't look like we were going to be beat.
Just like one last quick one on the Dragon, so we can move to the second like part of your career. Was there any mention of it at that halftime that the Roosters, because they were wooden spooners the year previous, and they were trying to become the first team to go from wooden spooners to premiership winners since freaking like the 30s or something. Is that touched on at all during the week?
No. Cool.
Wicked.
We were the best team. I remember.
Because that would have been a media thing.
Like, yeah, I think I don't know when the Dally M's were that year. Maybe it was a little bit earlier or the week before or something like that. But Brian Smith had got Coach of the Year. Todd Carney got Dally M Player of the Year. And I remember us getting on the bus and we were filthy. Yeah. Absolutely filthy. Yeah, you know, we'd finished first 2 years in a row, which was hard to do. Darius, yeah, in my eyes, won that Dally M medal well and truly before the season. And both seasons, you know, we finished, I think we lost three out of our last four or whatever. But, you know, Darius was outstanding at the back. That, and he got showed
Clive Churchill, yeah?
Yeah, he got Clive Churchill. But he deserved that Dally M medal. And we were filthy that we didn't get more respect and for the hard work we'd done.
You mentioned Brett Morris. I've read this now. You mentioned Brett Morris is your, I wouldn't say favorite player, but the best player in their position that you've ever played with, and one of the best wingers of all time. You mentioned like speed.
The best. He's the best.
That's awesome. Is there what's the way to put this? The word underrated is used a lot, but was there a player, we'll say your whole career, who was working just as hard as everyone, was as important to the winning as anyone, but you felt maybe didn't get the kudos outside the club, like it mattered anyway, like he was valued in the club, but is there a player you'd be able to pinpoint there?
Look, just quickly on Brett, 160 odd tries, has done it for, nearly 15 years. Yeah, that's the best winger of all time.
At every club he's been at.
Yeah, I don't care what anyone says. I'll put Brett Morris up against anyone. So, but guys like Jason Nightingale, I picked my team. I had to leave him out. Yeah, probably didn't get enough credit throughout his career. One guy that stood out was Ben Hornby. That move from fullback to halfback. Darren Lockyer was celebrated to move to 5'8", and rightly so. One of the greatest players to ever play. But the move from Benny to move from fullback to halfback for our team so Darius could play there was enormous. And, for 2 years, we'd been criticised about, we can't win a comp with Ben Hornby at halfback. No, it just won't work. Yeah, him and Soward, the combination just won't work. It just won't work. And I remember Grand Final night saying that, choke on that. Benny Hornby's halfback, he was our captain. Now, I don't think he ever got enough credit for his willingness to be able to sacrifice but also lead the team and come up with the big plays at the right time. And you look back and some of those games, the subtlety, especially in the grand final, the subtlety in which he went about his business, I don't think he ever got enough credit.
Before the show, when I was talking to my cousin, the Dragon supporter, we actually compared you and Hornby, your partnership in the halves, to what we've seen the last 2 years with Kronk and Keary, where Kronk was the cool, calm, collected sort of experienced head and Keary was the free-flowing, running, flashy, setting up the tries, that sort of stuff. And I was like, that's very much how I remembered you playing, the running, the flash, the one-hand dummy, the kicking.
I don't know who's going to listen to this, but I'm not comparing ourselves to Keary and Kronk. Don't worry about that. But
with regards to the running 5'8", like, we saw what Kronk did in the grand final. He hardly touched the ball, but just being out there and organising and controlling and slowing things and then just letting Keary just do his thing. I think Hornby played a similar role to that where he didn't have to be a man of the match performer all the time. And maybe that's what people were looking for because of how good he was as fullback.
Yeah, I think Cooper, the last 2 years has really shown how tactically brilliant he's been throughout his career and how good an organizer he'd been. And if you remember back to the start of 2018, there was a lot of hands on the ball from Cooper and trying to organize and stuff like that. And the Roosters struggled the first, I think they were 3-4 or 4-3 the first 8 games of the year. And then they played against Cronulla where he took a step back and Keary dominated possession that night and got Tedesco involved, and they beat Cronulla easily. But that was, you know, that was a masterstroke from Cooper and Trent to be able to get that together, because Cooper had realised that Keary's got all the skills. He just needs someone to put him in position. I think, you know, a lot of the times the way we played the Dragons was, you know, when we went left, Benny was going to give the ball to Darius in the right position for Darius to come up with the play. And then if it came to the right-hand side, he was going to put me in position to be able to run and come up with a play. So, again, that's why he was underrated and not valued enough as a halfback, for him putting himself in the right position to put the team in the right area to be able to come up with the right plays. And, you know, like I said, Darius came up with 50 try assists in 2 years or something ridiculous like that. And all those moments wouldn't have been able to happen if Benny wasn't leading and putting it in the right direction, as per the Roosters with Cooper.
So this is all the good stuff, and then all good things come to an end. So Bennett leaves at the end of 2011. Mm-hmm. Before that, though, you've done the World Club Challenge. You go there and beat Wigan. What was that like? Moving to Penrith and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it was a whirlwind tour. I mean, we did it in 8 days. We flew over. I don't really know what to expect. We're playing against Wigan. I always felt like the Super League was 10 years behind us, you know, in terms of their skill level and everything like that. I mean, no one had ever left the NRL in their prime to go over and play in the Super League in their prime sort of thing. Yeah. So we just got off the plane, trained, you know, bounced in. It was a tough game. It was one of those environments that you'll never forget because the crowd's right on top of you. And we came away with a win. We celebrated in Hong Kong. It was a pretty good trip.
Love it.
Can't share too many stories from honkers.
2000, and then, yeah, so Bennett leaves, goes to Newcastle. You play another couple of seasons, the Dragons under Steve Price, and then it was kind of form a dip, different relationship, I guess, with the coach, maybe, is pretty much what's released. And then you're put back to New South Wales Cup. You signed a contract with Penrith starting the next season, but you weren't granted a release. So you took up an option with the London Broncos.
Yeah, it was, the relationship between Pricey and I when he was assistant coach was probably as tight as through those 3 years. When he'd moved to first grade coach, there was an unwillingness from, I guess, myself to want to change what had worked under Wayne. Yeah, there was a lot of Pricey trying to put his own imprint on it, and I'm sure he'd agree that he handled some situations, I handled some situations. We had some off-field stuff going on. You know, I had some off-field stuff going on in my own personal life and all that kind of stuff that all led to that moment of me being dropped. And, you know, I wanted a contract at the Dragons. I was filthy. I wasn't getting a contract offer in 2013, so my form had started to dip. And I got offered 1 year. Penrith offered me 4. I'd signed. And as soon as I signed, I got dropped and not allowed to train with a full-time squad. And
wow,
it was just all that lead up, you know, and I've spoken about it before, and me and Pricey are sweet now, but
yeah.
I think at that time, you know, he was a young coach trying to put his imprint on the NRL world and the squad. And we'd had an aging squad who had been successful a certain way. And, you know, like I said, that unwillingness to change and I guess, you know, the boredom from me in what we were doing at some things weren't getting results and stuff like that. So that all happened. Go to London, come back and you know, take up the 4 year deal with Penrith. But
what was playing in London like? So actually playing in the Super League as opposed to World Club Challenge?
Yeah, I went twice. Both times I played with the worst club.
Super
League. Yeah, so not in terms of worst club, but I mean they were coming last
in
second division. So look, it was tough. You know, Penrith didn't want me to go over there straight away because they were going good at the time. The expectations, if I come across and wreck that, then I'm there for 4 years. And you know, it was a smart move by Penrith, and the Dragons sort of just wanted me out. So I've always felt disrespected that I never got enough respect from the Dragons at the end of my career there, and yeah, never got the lap of honour and all that kind of stuff that goes along with people that have won championship with the club, and hopefully one day it happens. But yeah, that sort of always been a bit of a sticking point for me. And to go to London twice, it was good. You know, we got beat 70-odd nil in a semi-final on national TV, which wasn't great. But look, I think, you know, the game over there is it's different. It's fast-paced. It's plenty of points. It's, you know, the powerhouses of the competition dominate. They've only had four winners of the Super League era. So that would be the NRL era for us. They've only had four winners in the last 23 years, which has been Bradford, who are now in third division or second division, Leeds, Wigan, and St. Helens. So that's why I think the competition over there is, you know, no, if we had a reserve grade team based over there, they'd be able to comfortably make the top five.
Wow. It's, yeah, I was saying earlier before I could see your face on things, and it's, we talked to Flanagan, I think, about the Super League, and people going, oh, it's like, it'd be a great experience, family experience. And you're just like, I guess you didn't plan on going there at that stage. And it was kind of to be able to keep playing footy for the second half of the season or play reserve grade back home. So,
well, I played reserve grade a couple of times, and it was mentally, I needed to get away.
Mm.
I needed to get out of that. I was in the toxic part of the relationship with the Dragons, and I needed to escape to get over to England. So I did that. And then it was same at Penrith, you know, when they'd said that it was time for me to move on, I wasn't going to sit around in reserve grade and play, you know, and fill out my contract year in 2017.
Yeah.
And I took a huge hit financially, but for my mental well-being to get away from that and then move on with my life, it's the best thing I've ever done. So I think sometimes we get caught up in the decision that, oh, it's, you know, I have to play so I can get that money. Well, there's other ways you can make money. You just got to back yourself and look after yourself mentally. And you know, when I left Penrith, I'd come off a tough 2 years off field mentally to get into that position. And then when I retired, so I'd done all that in 3 years. So mentally, I was ready to get out of the game and look for the next challenge.
So in Penrith, like you had your back surgery, like 3 in 6 months. When you came back, and you're saying the mental toll, I never played, obviously, anywhere near as high, but I had an ACL, Rico, when I was 17, and it took me till even my early 20s to get it out of the back of my head. Mm. Were you reserved when you came back? Was that part of the mental side of things? Or?
Yeah, see, I mean, to 2015, I'd still dealt with a... Yeah, marriage breakup. So I was going through a divorce. You know, I was living by myself. So mentally, I probably wasn't in the best space. Then I hurt, you know, we start the year, we win the first game against Newcastle, and I hurt my back, missed the second game, and then play the Titans. Bulldogs, sorry. We beat the Bulldogs at home, and we'd had that successful year in 2014. So we all thought it was our year. You know, I'd had ankle reconstruction in the off season to get a spur out and clean up. So I'd come back a little bit later in preseason. We beat the Bulldogs. I lose feeling in my left leg two days before, and then go out and Ivan at the time, you know, thought I was not faking it, but didn't really care that I'd lost feeling in my left leg probably as much as I did. And like I've always said, if it was my right leg, I wouldn't have cared because I can function. You know, I just needed to be able to feel my foot and leg when I was kicking.
Yeah.
I went out, you know, played the next week, got needled in my foot. It was like someone was holding a match to the bottom of my foot against the Titans. We beat them 40-odd nil, and we'd sort of talk behind the scenes about could I get through to round 8 or 9 with the rep weekend, and then could I get the surgery done and only be out 6 weeks. That was the decision I had to make. I wanted to keep playing, but I knew that I couldn't keep playing. Again, if it was my right leg, I would have just kept playing. But I couldn't keep playing with the uncertainty of my kicking was my biggest tool. I had to goal kick. I had to come up with the right plays. I couldn't, you know, go out there and not feel my foot from week to week. I had the surgery. Probably disagreed with the coaching staff at the time. Again, you know, whether they thought I was soft or whatever, but the disc had shown that it was pushing up against my nerve. which wasn't able to let me function how I wanted to function. And it was going to, you know, it's not only playing, you got training, you got all that kind of stuff to be able to get yourself ready. Go in, have the surgery, shave it down. And about 3 or 4 days later, I'm pretty much at a Roosters game leaning on my side. And they're like, you know, we'll get you back in the gym next week. And I was 5 days post-surgery. I felt like something was wrong. And I rang my mate and he took me to the doctors and the disc had slipped out again. So I had to go back in again. And then pushed.
And the club was trying to turn you out of the gym. Bloody hell.
Yeah. It was a bit of a mental headspace for me, but I think I pushed and played, you know, maybe 10 or 8 weeks later. Really pushed hard to try and get back because the team was struggling. Wallace had been injured and we just tried to get back out in the field. You know, fast forward, the rest of that season's a write-off again, dealing with divorce and all that kind of stuff. You know, I meet my wife at the end of the year, my new wife at the end of the year, and get myself real super fit in pre-season. And then, you know, I think a week before Christmas, the disc had slipped out again. So I had to go back in again. And yeah, I think I played 8 weeks after that, maybe less, up in Papua New Guinea. But yeah, it was, I wouldn't say, yeah, I mean, players always want to get back and play, but probably it wasn't looked after as much as what, you know, I would like to have been because of whatever the reputation was or whatever they were going through at the time. But yeah, I'm pretty disappointed looking back because I've had back pain ever since I retired and yeah, it's gone into my neck and stuff like that. And that's footy, but yeah, it's hard to swallow knowing that, you know, I got pushed back pretty quickly because they thought I was soft or, you know, they didn't think it was a serious injury because your back's one of your most important things.
Mm. I've only got two more footy questions, so I'm really interested to see what you're doing now. Yeah. With regards to Penrith, best player or best teammate, regardless of whether it was on field, off field, best bloke to hang with?
James Seguiaro was always a blast. There was always something going on in Chico's life. You know, he's always had a laugh. But that 2014 team, you know, you look it back, Josh Mansell played for Australia. Matt Moylan played, I think he played for Australia or played in State of Origin a year later. He, Moyes, you know, he was class. You know, fully fit, right situation, right time. He's, you know, probably one of the best guy that was in the best form throughout that sort of period.
Yeah, cool. And I guess the question gets thrown around a lot. Like best, I'm just going to bring something up on my screen here. Best player you've played against, and you've been asked a similar question that before, and I just want to give you back your answer, see if you remember this. I think this is an interview with NRL. And it says the best you came up against, and this is from you. So when I made my debut against Queensland in 2011, I ran out for my first game at Suncorp Stadium and I was shitting myself. The game was on the line. It was 12-10 and I looked up and I watched the ball go from Cameron Smith to Jonathan Thurston to Darren Lockyer to Greg Inglis, who passed it inside to Billy Slater and then linked up with Cooper Cronk. Does that pretty much answer the question of the best player you've played against?
Yeah, that wasn't the play. The play was Slater. We kicked down. Slater gets the ball, runs it back. I think GI has a carry. Thurston shifts to Lockyer. This is the whole set. And then, anyway, they cronked on the field and they pass the ball to Lockyer, who passed it inside to Slater to score the winning try. But, you know, it looked back and you think about the best players you've played against, and at the time, to lose that series 2-1 is quite an achievement.
Yeah, that's the one thing I see. We thought we'd get more 3-0s in that, but
well, I don't think any Origin series is an easy 3-0. But I was lucky enough, or unlucky enough, to play in Lockie's last ever Origin game and last ever game for Brisbane. So there's a nice little bit of trivia.
Did not know that. Well, I'm just having a look. I think that's all pretty much the footy questions we had. So, oh no, one more. Indigenous All-Stars, you were there for the inaugural game. Get to represent your people and their culture. And just seeing what it's morphed into. What, one, how was that experience? And two, how do you like how it's morphed into with the Aboriginal All-Stars and the Maori All-Stars? Because I freaking love that match earlier this year with the tribalism at the start and the pride. So going from the All-Stars to the sorry, the non-Indigenous All-Stars to Maori versus Aboriginal.
Yeah. I think the mix right now is perfect.
Yeah.
For me, personally, I'd like it a week later. I think that if everyone had a trial with their team, it's probably easier to take because it's such an intensity, it's such an intense week that, if they'd had 40 minutes under their belt, we'd probably see a better game in terms of skill-wise.
Yeah.
You know, the intensity is always going to be there, the emotion's always going to be there, but, you're sort of watching it, enjoying the game as hyped as you can be, but realising that I hope no one gets injured.
Yeah.
I hope everyone's ready to go. So that for me, I think should be a week later. Being a part of three of those games, there was a couple of special moments. I mean, I was sort of a young man when I played in that first one. I roomed with Jonathan Thurston, which was outstanding.
Oh, man.
Got to see how he worked on and off the field, picked his brain a little bit. And that was at the start of 2009, I think.
It was like Preston Campbell's big.
Yeah, it was his idea. Well, I actually played with Presto. I was pretty lucky because I played with Presto in the 2008 World Cup showpiece against the Maldives and roomed with him. And so I was a part of the inaugural team.
Yeah.
I mean, KT and the rest of the boys were playing for Australia. But, we were part of that and we've realised it was something special. So to be a part of those clashes is always amazing. I think the last one, for me in 2016 was probably my most memorable, knowing that it was going to be my last time being called into the squad and a lot older and knew my career was coming to an end, and to be able to go out there and perform on that big stage again was great. But it's such an emotional connection to not only the community and the tribalism, as you mentioned, but to yourself, to be in that group with, a bunch of black fellas that just love playing footy and having a laugh for the whole week. It's certainly a memorable experience.
I love it. It's something I look forward to every year. And I agree with you. I think the balance that it is now is perfect. It was, and then the women's game as well was brutal. It was, so moving on to, post footy. So you met your now wife. Is it Mia?
Yep. Sorry?
Mia? Is that how you pronounce
Maddie.
It? Maddie, sorry. I'm getting it mixed up with Indy.
Yeah.
Sorry. My bad, guys.
All good.
Your first job afterwards was selling bathroom fittings.
Yeah, selling shitters.
I was going to put a nice spin on it, but anyway.
It's a good story. So Maddie's my wife, Indiana's. She's 2 this year, so... Maddie's worked at Harvey Norman for nearly 10 years in the commercial, offices, the corporate offices. And I'd sort of sat around and not really done much in retirement. And she mentioned that she could get me a job in bathrooms. And it was the best job because I had a really great boss who didn't expect me, when she sort of took me on as a bit of a favour to Maddie and didn't know what to expect. And I was keen to learn and sell things because obviously there's a commission. But at the end of the day, there was people there that their livelihood depended on making sales, and I was more there just to put myself in a position to be the morale booster for the whole store. So, I'd go out the back and talk to the gear guys and all the people in the warehouse. I'd go up and talk to bedrooms, and then if someone needed help, I'd always greet them as they come in. So I just enjoyed that time, person giving me a job out there at Penrith, and people couldn't realise why I wasn't at training. They didn't realise I'd retired because I sort of just did it quietly and moved on. So people would say, "Oh, you're playing this year? How come you're not at training?" And I just said, I'm selling. I'm just here working now, and I think it was funny because once I did that, I wanted to work in the media, and I sort of hadn't had many leads, but it was like I got reward for going out and getting a job. And once I'd worked, I worked a whole year. And once I took that job, I started getting media opportunities. And I did both. I did all of them for a long time. So, I was very grateful that, Maddie got me the job. But it's great selling shitters to 60-year-olds who don't want to spend a lot of money. So, I just enjoyed the convo, mate. It was, like I said, very humbling and, great experience.
From there, you've mentioned a few times, want to get into media, and you've done some commentary. 2017, you started at Fox Sports. You've done some commentary with 2GB, who I believe you're still with, doing some Canterbury Cup sort of commentating. Couple of questions. Is it hard to commentate coming from an ex-player, or is there still training and practice involved? How'd you find commentating?
So I've got an opportunity.
I love listening to you on the radio. I think it's one hilarious because you're straight down the line. And it seems like there's times where you've held yourself back going, oh, that was a shit play. And then having to go to, that's not what could have been done in that situation.
You get told you don't want to be negative. You want both sides because you're not just commentating for one side of fans. You're commentating for three, the neutral who loves footy, and obviously the other sides. But I got an opportunity at Fox. I was doing a little bit at Fox. I'd been working there. Bill and Boz, that sort of, I had two parts. I had my commentary dream where I wanted to get into calling games, being the colour. And then I was doing the media stuff because I love all sports, American sports and stuff like that. So I got real opportunity at the 2018. Yeah, Joel Kane had offered me to come across to Channel 9 and do the Canterbury Cup. And I really enjoy that because, like you said, I can be myself. There's only one other person to go to. I can be a little bit, off-centre if I want to be, and I can also have a bit of fun. So I enjoy that next crop of talent coming through. And, it's a nice little crew on a Sunday afternoon. We can just get in and out and call the footy and have fun. 2GB was big for me because I'd grown up listening to that. Worked at Triple M for nearly 4 years on and off and getting the call up here or there and part-time. But for me, it was like a real proud achievement to get the call from 2GB because they've been the leader in rugby league coverage for so long that, those guys are some of the greatest to ever be a part of broadcasting.
Definitely.
So to get that opportunity and to be back this year, although it's been short, my second year, it's pretty cool. So is it hard to commentate? I think I got told when I was 19, I only did one media training session. If I can capture your attention in 10 seconds, I've pretty much got you. So if I'm talking shit, and I lose you, then you can't keep longevity in the game. So I've just tried to do that across all my platforms that I do and whatever I do, I try and capture your attention in the first 10 seconds and hopefully that translates to when I'm talking footy. And I think not taking yourself too serious, you've got to have a balance. There's a lot of people that are serious in the media and great analysts and tactically way smarter than I'll ever be. Then there's funnier guys that'll be funnier than I ever be, but I like to just group myself right in the middle there and have a bit of both. And
the balance.
I think that creates a different look at how people can listen to my stuff or view my stuff. And I'm, like I said, I'm not under any illusions that people aren't going to listen to me and don't like listening to me. But, people don't like listening to Ray Warren and some of the greats of the game. So I just think that if I can just group myself in the middle there, have fun while I'm doing it, hopefully what I'm talking about comes out.
Only got a couple more. Fox Sports going on the back page. So this is like one of the few sports shows. Like that's pretty much all I watch on TV, sport. And this is one of the shows that my wife loves watching. And we loved it when you were on there. You're one of the best regular guests to come on. And Kerry O'Keefe, before he became a more permanent member on there, anytime you guys were coming on, especially when you were both on at the same time, it was freaking hilarious. And especially with Kelly Underwood, how she's trying to bring everything back so serious and so blah, blah, blah. And the rest of it is going off. What was that crew like to work with? And the only time I ever saw you serious on there is when you were talking about the Celtics and the NBA. And that's something we're going to finish on. But best moment from work on Backpage, because it's freaking hilarious sometimes.
Yeah, it's a shame because obviously, the last 2 years they've got a huge media team there. So the opportunities on Backpage, they don't need outside talent. So they'd rather get people on that they've got on the books, which is, smart financially. Yeah. I really enjoyed doing that show because I'd become really good friends with Tony Squires and Kelly so and good. Crash.
One of the best hosts.
They're all so good. So working with Fitzy was great. He was always funny and
when you two were
his one liners were outstanding. But Kerry O'Keefe was probably my highlight. I'd introduce myself to him because I don't take for granted that anyone might not know who I am now. Yeah. You know, Kerry's a massive Dragons fan, so he knew who I was. But I just I went up to him, and there was two moments. I said to Kerry, "G'day, Kerry. I'm James Howard. Nice to meet you." He goes, "I know who you are, young man." And I said, "Oh, okay." And he starts rattling off my stats. And I was like, "Oh," he goes, "yeah, 6 from 7 grand final and this how many points and blah, 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 blah." And I was like, "Oh, okay. Nice to meet you." Like, I was just in awe that he even knew who I was, let alone my stats. The other time was with Tony. He'd been begging me to bring in the grand final ring, and I brought it in one night and took it off pre-show, and we're having the meeting and stuff like that, and he's wearing it around and he's strutting around the office and he's showing everyone. And I left it. I just thought, well, he's going to give it back to me before the show starts.
No way. Can wear it.
And he's walking around. And anyway, we get ready. We go out on the thing. And about 30 seconds before we go on air, we're all sitting there laughing and stuff like that. And I just looked across. And I didn't want to be rude. And I just said, "Hey, Tone, are you going to wear that for the show?" And he said, "I can't get it off." He goes, "I cannot get it off. So, yes, I am wearing it." He goes, "I've been crying for half an hour. I can't get it off. My finger's swollen up." So he wore it for the show. And then at the end, he had to get a little bit of water and stuff like that and try and get it off. And he did. But, yeah, he go back classic. And on that show. He wears it for the whole show. So, but great people. Really happy to have had a little bit of time and shared with them, because I really enjoyed that show.
And we're going to finish on your new podcast, and pretty much from everything you've said, the name of it obviously links with your last name, but it kind of represents your career as well, Sweet and Soured. So you've had, as much as anyone, positive and negative parts of your career. And you said it's kicked off 2020, yep. And you work with Nick Davis, ex-Sydney Swans player, and it's about introducing, I guess, American sport culture to Australians who may not be aware is not the right word, but knowledgeable about it, what their culture's like. How you been finding it? Fun? You did in front of a live audience, is that right?
No, we did the first one in front of a live audience. We've got, you know, 4 or 5 sponsors on board that have been great in terms of, you know, giving us some money to get equipment and stuff like that, which is why I can do podcasts from my home now, and I've learned how to do that. So, it started off like that. The sporting landscape's changed the last 2 months because we haven't had much to talk about. So we've more or less been talking about NRL, and we did a chocolate knockout. I think we're going to do beers next. But I think trying to introduce American sport culture to Australia is important because, one, pretty much everyone, all the suits, they all gamble on it. So you're going to get an easy listening audience there, but everyone has a basketball singlet or have seen LeBron James and whatever else. So just introducing the fact that not everyone has to be that great guy, that they can, look at the American sports landscape. And obviously it's hard at the moment. We're talking a lot about other stuff and we've got a few characters on the show, but I just wanted to start a show every Tuesday night to be able to do and talk with a couple of mates. And I went into business and registered the Sweet and Sour business name, and hopefully start doing functions and all that kind of stuff. But I just wanted an opportunity to really get together with some guys that I'd worked with in the past and still do, and come up with ideas to be able to have fun and realize, sort of make people aware of what's going on. And my opinion, I work so hard during the NRL season to give so many serious opinions about X's and O's that it's nice to have a little bit of fun and take the piss. And it's been good. Like I said, the last month and a bit, it's been a bit challenging because we're coming up with different ways, and we've been interviewing, you mentioned Kyle Flanagan. We did Kyle last week. We did Chad Townsend. We've done Dean Young, Cameron King, and we did Sammy Bremner the other day. So it's about getting those out, and it's right now is the opportunity to get interviews done because everyone's looking for an opportunity to do something. But I enjoy it. I think it's nice to see everyone coming up with content and enjoying it, and the interaction. Like I said, as long as you do it respectfully, I'll always interact with people. But sometimes you get a little bit hairy, but that's why I love Twitter, because I can say whatever I want.
That's pretty much how Jared and I started. We just used to chat NRL, and there was stuff that the media or the broadcast partners never talked about. Now, we figured they were too nice sometimes, the teams. They were too complimentary. Sometimes they're giving other teams heart, but never going into analytical reasons why, rather than it's just what they were saying. Yeah. And we started doing that. And then, like I said, I'm a big American sports fan as well. I subscribe to The Athletic and looking at all their articles that are coming out, and they're scrambling, and they're in such a worse they're doing so much worse than we are. There's how long it's going to be till sports over there. It's amazing to see what they're talking about. And talking about how big a fan you are, you proposed to your wife at TD Garden. Is that right?
Yeah.
Your daughter's named Indy after the state bird. Is that also right?
It's so I actually proposed in Australia, so the ring was insured. Ended up, I thought we were just getting a photo, and the lady took us down on centre court. So we've reenacted that one on centre court of TD Garden.
Cool. Yeah.
2017. I went back and watched Paul Pierce raise his jersey to the banner with my best mate. I've got the postcode tattooed on my ass inside a little clover. Indiana. So Larry Bird was born in the state of Indiana, French Lick, Indiana. And
he's your favourite player?
He's my favourite player. I've got his number tattooed.
Number three?
On the back of each arm. Yeah. 33 on each arm.
33, sorry, yeah.
And then, I met Paul Pierce last year. He came out and, was doing a thing through with Jonathan Thurston. I was lucky enough, I had to help host, and they got me a gig there. So he put a signature on me left cheek above the postcode, and I went and got it tattooed on me. So
that is brilliant.
I'm a diehard Celtics fan, and Indiana and Maddie didn't have a choice. So it's great because Maddie's we're obviously Kings fans as well, but Sydney Kings fans, but Maddie's right into the Celtics. So we don't have any other teams or jerseys or anything like that. We're strictly Celtics in this house.
Are you straight? And you straight down NBA? Do you give the other guys other sports a look as well?
Yeah, so obviously Red Sox.
You're all the Boston sort of.
Bruins only because I've been to a game. Bruins, obviously like, but I've always for 10-12 years since Katrina, I've always liked Drew Brees. So I've been going for New Orleans. Okay. Just like the fact that he was a little guy and the way he held himself and competed and got the big plays done. So, I'm a bit of a sports fanatic. I don't know, probably my last thing in college, I don't know why I go for Oklahoma, but I've always had a soft spot for Oklahoma.
Are they Sooners?
The Sooners. So, I'll pretty much watch anything. Anything that anyone can compete in, I'll watch anything and pick a side.
Well, I hate three of your teams, all the Boston ones. We won't talk about them, but it's awesome. So, all right, we're gonna finish with just some numbers. I want you, if you can, tell me what these numbers mean. 398
points I scored in 2004.
No. Goals you've kicked for St. George, still the highest number.
Okay.
234.
Goals I kicked for Penrith.
Most points in a season.
My most points.
And for St. George.
2009. Yeah, 2009.
977.
Points for the Dragons.
That's leading it.
Points. I should have had 1,000.
You're topping three all-time stats for one of the most storied franchises. That's something pretty cool to have in the history. Gareth Widdop almost caught you on goals. So lucky you retired. Otherwise, you wouldn't have had that one. And 22 points in a match is still most for Penrith with Ivan Cleary and... who was the other one?
No, Nathan Cleary scored 34.
Nathan Cleary, sorry. I was just saying Ivan Cleary. Maloney at Penrith. So you've got a record over there as well. So, that 22 points. That was with St. George as well, your time with Ben Hornby there and Gareth Widdop. That's huge. So we've been through so much stuff there. You've given us a whole bunch of time. So I just want to say thank you on behalf of Jared and I and the Six Again podcast. We're just trying to do our thing. To our listeners as well, make sure you check out Sweet and Soured. It's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. It drops Tuesday nights.
Yeah, every Wednesday.
Wednesday morning.
Keep an eye out. Yeah, we've been dropping those little ISO 15, 20-minute podcasts. with the former players or current players as well. So they're always good fun. It's all positive. It's not about their not necessarily their career. It's about some of their biggest moments, you know, some of their best memories. So yeah, they're just good little fun podcasts that you can knock over in 20-25 minutes.
20 minutes. That's I'm definitely going to be checking that out, because just for a lot of the stuff you've talked about, it's a lot of stuff that I played my career like, and it's still the smaller sort of get in and give it a go players are my favourites and kind of always has been. Now, Steve Menzies for Manly is definitely not the most athletic of players, but damn, he was smart and he'd get in his way. Just to finish off, do you have a favourite player in the NRL right now that you just love watching or love how they go about their game?
Keary's up there. I like Keary. Yeah, it's tough. Jack Whiten probably took me by surprise last year. I like watching him. I like watching Hodgson. There's a heap of guys that you sit down and watch that you can see their game develop, that they're probably, I mean, there's teams that are certainly years ahead, but that talent, you know, from Luke Keary, to watch him, that's why I was disappointed this year, obviously because the game stops and we're out of work, but his development without Cooper Cronk, yeah, and how he would have been able to work that out. An 0-2 start, so hopefully we get to see that. But if I had to pick one guy to watch, it would be Luke Keary.
All right, cool. I'm going with Brandon Smith from the Storm. Love what he does.
Yeah, well, I love watching him as well, but I just probably from a tactical point of view.
Oh, yeah. I see what Keary, you're saying. Keary, can't compare those two.
Well, no, he's just straight up and down the cheese. He won't. He doesn't miss anything.
All right. Thank you so much, Jamie.
No worries, mate. Appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
Good luck with everything you've got going on, and hopefully we'll catch you down the track.
No worries, mate. Thanks again.
Jared's just shaking his head because that last attempt I did to get us back on didn't work as well as
it hurt my ears. He screamed in the bloody microphone.
I was excited. It was a good interview. It was fun.
It was a really good interview.
I hope you guys really enjoyed that. We said on the pod already, that's why this episode's titled Sweet and Soured. So Jamie's got his new podcast out. Jump on there and have a listen. And again, thank you to Jamie for being such an awesome dude and getting back to us and giving us a really in-depth interview covering pretty much his entire footy career. So news from us, you might have seen it already, that, oh, hi, Kalisha.
Yeah, Kalisha's in it now. We've got to come in a wave now.
This is only on YouTube. It's all good.
Yeah. She can't hear you, baby.
So we've got a new logo. You would have seen it jumping around. It's got a few different versions of it. Just want to do a huge shout out to Aaron Lodder Design. We've linked him on a whole bunch of he was awesome. He got back to us really quick. He got it done really well and really well priced. So if you're looking at that sort of design work, he does a whole bunch of other stuff. You can jump on his Instagram and have a look, or his website's already in the video description on this as well. Now, with everything going on, when are we doing our next show, Jared?
So we're going back to 2 a week now.
Yeah, we're gonna have to.
Me and Adam started this as a bit of a, you know, play around kind of thing, because we both like talking about rugby league, but it has gone so much further than we thought it would. And we're really happy for all the people who supported us with it, like Aaron Lodder, my brother Billy, a few other people that really put their hands up and helped us out. So we really appreciated that. So yeah, we're going back to 2 a week now. Hopefully before the season starts, we'll be able to set that up, because we've got so much content we're ready to give you guys.
Yeah.
Which is really great. So
outside of the interviews, we've only just been touching on some things, like all that TV stuff at the start we could have talked about for ages. So we're going to go back to recording on Sunday nights and Wednesday nights, dropping Monday and Thursday mornings.
And this week, we're going to post 2 more interviews this week after Soured.
Hopefully.
So hopefully.
All comes together.
We'll post a few hints on Facebook and Instagram so people will get out there and try and guess who they are.
Yeah,
which is really cool. And as previously touched on, we now have Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. We're on every single platform you can imagine. Just search into Six Again Pod. You can find, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so with regards to LinkedIn, that's our personal profiles, Six Again. And obviously, it's on our YouTube channel. Hit the subscribe button, like, share it between all your mates, and we'll probably see you guys Thursday morning.
Yeah. See you guys.
See ya.
Thank you for tuning in to Six Again. Connect with the show on Twitter, Instagram, and the Six Again website. All links via the show's bio. Be sure to check out Adam's craft beer choice of the week.